Okay. Thanks, Dimitri. Look, first of all, you know, if we start with apologies and, you know, scrape and bower, et cetera, this is definitely a working paper. So, I mean, I think a couple of the sections could possibly be moved around and, you know, I'll probably change it, et cetera. But look, my main interest is in critical philosophy of the environment and working on ways to use continental philosophy to refresh existing environmental thinking and to open up extant conversations in continental philosophy to questions of environmental politics and values. In some sense, you know, I start from a position of claiming a certain mutual poverty, on both, which might be ameliorated by forcing open avenues for mutual contamination between those two zones. And so what I'm going to do is, after some introductory comments about the object text of this paper, Robinson Crusoe, I'll then connect to eco-criticism, a field of literary criticism not yet 20 years old, but I would say perhaps already running the risk of declining into placid acceptance and perhaps only marginal importance, instead of what I think it should be doing is developing further into areas of critical inquiry. I think eco-criticism should be increasingly relevant at a time when the problems of environmental destruction and climate change are widely assumed to be preeminent concerns for the foreseeable future. Yet, the political and ethical will to counter them remains elusive. I mean, and that's where my view is of the present, is that we're in a kind of interregnum period when, after several waves of finding out, you know, major problems of environmental destruction, etc., but we're now at a period of looking at ethical and political will, and this is possibly one of the most important questions of the early 21st century. So I'm coming from a view where I think the philosophical task, given that, is to critically understand the character of the human place in given nature, not as standing out, exception, or diremptive relation, but as ecological thought increasingly explains as a particular set of relations to the living and non-living, mutually determining. So, you know, I'd go so far as I think where this sort of problem is going is, going so far as to say all human social life, even the most advanced, needs to be considered as part of nature. And some ecological thinking tries to do that, and I think that's the correct direction. And it will be away from a view of human society and culture as a kind of standing out. So after those sort of introductory comments, I'm going to discuss The Life and Strange Surprising Adventures of Robinson Crusoe by Daniel Defoe, which is commonly known as the Robinson Crusoe, even though, of course, there was a later volume of Further Adventures and a third volume entitled Serious Reflections during The Life and Surprising Adventures of Robinson Crusoe. I'll aim at some provisional conclusions about this sort of philosophical work. So to start with, why Robinson Crusoe and the story of the isolated castaway? Look, I start with a classic commentary. In The Rise of the Novel, 1967, Ian Watt states, "Robinson Crusoe is certainly the first novel in the sense that it is the first fictional narrative in which an ordinary person's daily activities are the centre of continuous literary attention." Now, I don't intend to canvass the debates about the question of origins or first. I think recently Derrida and The Beast and the Sovereign deconstructed such claims, both of Agamben's various firsts and then the idea of Robinson Crusoe is a first, the very idea of a first or arche that will repeat its character forward in successive forms has been deflated at least since Nietzsche. But the practice and positing of such arche is of course most relevant. Robinson Crusoe has been positioned as an arche, or what I would rather call a communarchic point or intersection, when types of text through their dissemination engage not only in reshaping a textual generic field, but also engage in redefining their interlocutors through providing new means for self-interpretation or interpretation of the social body or community to which they belong, hence communarchic. Writing or language, I believe, and that's another argument, has this characteristic in a wider sense. That's another paper. What places the text at the dawn of modern liberal individualism, when the literacy of a rising urban middle class could be engaged by the new commoditized narratives which reflected back to their readers images of the very social conditions which allowed for their increasing circulation? We know this story, I think. Leisure time, moderately increasing surplus wealth, emerging secular moral freedoms and problems, social mobility, upwards and downwards, colonial endeavours. new forms of class relations. The increasing importance of secular merit for individual lives, still a novel concept, no pun intended, and far from settled in value, was parlayed into a literature of the ordinary person. The novel, crudely put, arrives as a thing of the emerging, literate, metropolitan middle class. Robinson Crusoe occupies a special place in the formation of this scene and the modern imaginary, because it is also one of the first narratives of an ordinary individual who strives for wealth and advancement only to suffer a dreadful fall and isolation from society, followed by triumph, and it is told through both through events and reported inner life. The fabula of events shows a sequence of protagonist-driven decisions and actions intersecting with spiritual autobiography, episodes of narrated thoughts, prayers, dreams, memories, and emotional intensities, often self-reflexive and co-textually related to form an impression of coherent social mind. The inner world of Robinson's suffering and outer world of events coalesce but unsteadily and are magnified through the dominant episode of physical isolation, where alternate focalisation in the narrative, inner, outer and back, takes the reader back and forth between objective conditions and inner representations. In that doubling and its immediately successful reception, it also foreshadowed a parallel cultural unease, best articulated a few decades later in the essays of Rousseau, which excoriated human society for isolating man from his essential self, demanding hollow mutual admiration, the fakery of amour propre necessary for social advancement. Daniel Defoe had already said something like it in the special reflections of Robinson Crusoe, where he wrote of the possible parallel of wilderness, isolation in metropolitan life. Modern urban anonymity can be a desert island for anyone on any particular day. And Rousseau enlarged upon what had already become common counter-discourse about the ruthless alienation of life in the cities, the vapid remains of aristocratic privilege and scant regard for the poor, etc. Rousseau famously thought Robinson Crusoe the only text worth giving to young Emile as part of a genuine education, because its lessons in self-sufficiency evaded the stale pretense of rote disciplined learning. Rousseau, of course, also scanned Robinson Crusoe narrowly, reading into it his version of the false versus proper conditions for human life, but in so doing initiated the philosophical Robinsonade as a critical tool against the unease of modernity, which in some sense has not ceased. One of the main versions of the philosophical Robinsonade is the autonomy of the modern ordinary individual, free or freely condemned, to pursue material well-being, accompanied problematically by ethical and political theories of the relevance and worth of such freedom. So I think the classic conundrum of that main philosophical Robinsonade is in fact really set out by the opposition between classical economics, which will find both an atomistic and genetic account of the free subject as economic unit in Robinson's labour, atom, most basic unit, genetic, begin from that basic unit and build up a picture of society. So classical economists do that, use Robinson that way. Marx will show this to be ideologically loaded, a justification of class domination and expropriation of surplus value. And they both argue about the worth and place of such an individual who labours and trades in order to survive. What is held to be the human in essence is translated into norms for the proper historical life for human beings, a theoretical inversion that takes the social type to be a trans-historical constant. This is a view of the place of the Robinsonade that is mundane and widely accepted. I'd like to focus on a somewhat different reading, but one that builds from that basic conjunction that I've just mentioned there. So to do that, I have to sketch briefly several steps in justification, and this is where the paper is a little bit more of a working paper. It's a type of, really what I'm kind of producing here is, it's an argument really about a literary genealogy that's going to produce a philosopheme. Robinson Crusoe is a literary figure who's been taken to stand categorically for the class of historically constituted free modern subjects. And I make the point, who now number in their billions, and of whom the question of the proper for the human has been consistently distilled in the same liberal formulae for nearly 300 years. I like this. For this reason, perhaps, we might be tempted to say we're all Robinson Crusoe now. I take the view that a crucial focus of environmental politics must be on the problem of the agency of those billions of subjects who are positioned in a compact with economic and sovereign powers that continue to prioritise versions of individual self-determination, as if the context of their actions is still an infinite world awaiting demands and expression. Now, you might make some arguments about, you know, I've just generalised grossly about agency, billions of subjects, etc. But another little part step here would be to say that we can build a very quick argument about convergence on a global scale and empire building that, you know, and I think across the globe there's a successful political trade between short-term political cycles and medium-term cycles of expansion and contraction that prioritise that same sort of subject. Really, the problem is of changing such agency as a huge political and an ethical problem. And so the Robinson Crusoe figure, that basic philosophine, is, if you like, the kind of literary genealogical archetype which echoes through. In thinking this through, I follow some of the work, how to change that sense of agency of the subject. I follow through the work of some of the work of Ian Hacking, particularly the paper entitled Making Up People from 1983, which I think is a great paper. In tracing some of the propositions from this and a number of related papers, I want to draw attention to an important argument implied by that strange title. Defining subjects brings into being that type of subject. It's a nominalism. Further, made-up people then causally interact in new ways with the social realities in which they participate. Not that they would not have participated at all had it not been for classification, but that something changes and social practices can be redefined and realigned because of classification. We are all classified all the time, but the question is in what way to what effect? It's a Foucauldian question. Now, interestingly, I think in that paper and a couple of others, such extrinsic classification from the inside, naming, etc., intersects with subjects' intrinsic self-definition. And this is the really interesting kind of hook that both Foucault and Hacking kind of pursue. Simply put, part of what makes ethical agency change and become newly effective is the ways in which subjects take on forms of self-definition that alter the frameworks for their actions and their sense of place in the world. If environmental values are to be mobilised, then it will take both the production of available forms of subject classification and their acceptance by subjects in order to change patterns of behaviour and thinking. So I think Hacking's dynamic nominalism points out how history shows it's not to be not only a possible, but a central part of modern normativity. If you want kind of concrete examples, the sort of shifts I'll be talking about would be quite a number. In really crude terms, I did another paper which is basically about what it means to be called green, and basically looking at extrinsic classification, people who call themselves or called environmentalist greenies or whatever, and then what happens when they accept that nominalism, and then what happens when that intersects with their intrinsic self-definition. You basically change agency, and Hacking's argument is basically that's one of the ways in which moral agency works, is through that intersection of extrinsic and intrinsic classification or nominalism. So, Robinson Crusoe is a narrative of self-definition. It's intrinsic. And it's about, in fact, the alteration of ethical agencies. To develop it further, I'd go a bit further and say it's a type of, in a literary sense, it's a confabulation of self in terms of relations to the world and others. A confabulation is a kind of ongoing rewriting, selection, reconstruction of history, often distorted in a psychoanalytic sense. But if you follow that kind of argument through, there is only distortions, of course. There are only confabulations of self. So I want to offer a type of experimental reading of Robinson Crusoe to attempt to bring out what I believe is an implicit or dormant interpretation of the text, which connects the standard figure of the liberal subject, that Robinsonard philosopheme to which he corresponds, with the demand to think how environmental ethical agency can be possible. That's what I'm doing. Now, how does this find a place in eco-criticism? This is where I kind of step sideways a little bit too. In thinking through that argument, I sort of wondered, you know, okay, how does this fit in as a part of eco-criticism? Eco-criticism has been changing a lot lately. It began as a school of criticism focused on nature writing and literature of wilderness, and that remains a central preoccupation. And I think that remains one of the kind of problems, if you like, with eco-criticism, is that it is stuck on nature writing. Interestingly, it also began negatively as a reaction against perceived distanciations of criticism from text-world relations, the terms of structuralism, post-structuralism, and diversity of approaches that commit themselves to the sign and signification as determining the meaningful constitution of human realities. In opposition to this abstraction, eco-criticism tried to valorise text-world relations, and I think some of this work is of great use. The literature of the experience of nature, of dyactic language in relation to natural space, place and time, proximity or felt affinities, the experience of the natural world that is not reducible to human social relations, was held to be worthy of critical attention when literary studies had become focused on symbolic registers. Early eco-criticism turned away from literary approaches that seemed to have foreclosed on the crucial functions of literature in expressing cultural negotiations with the natural world. The problem here was to posit human habitation as essentially symbolic and textual in character and to be defined as subjects inhabited by text has been interpreted eco-critically as diminishing the much-needed focus on contemporary ecological crises. You know, the issues that human force takes, exploits and increasingly reduces the world to human things. You know, the arguments were that loss and damage are irreplaceable. To try and deal with things and reduce things to questions of symbolic meaning or human social convention for eco-criticism is a real problem, and maybe you want to come back to that later because it's a problematic area. However, as one critic put it, the problem with eco-criticism engaging in political and ethical advocacy backed by the evidence of the natural sciences and opposing the sophisticated discussions of textuality is that it made itself a difficult member of the literary academy at a time when advocacy was motivated by the question of who speaks. Whereas political questions centred on human differentiation in literary studies, studying representations of class, race, gender or sexuality, could employ various identitarian logics to interrogate relevant cultural formations, a similarly framed plea to hear the voice of nature or defend its rights was a difficult inquiry to graft alongside those existing critical paradigms, and one perhaps that had a short lease of life. That problematic project in literary theory is mostly past, as several different commentators on the field agree, and I think the good news is eco-criticism is going past that kind of, what was a kind of blockage or impasse, and things such as post-colonial ecologies, critical geography, and the place of animals and animality in literature are widening and splintering that field. However, eco-criticism, I would argue, still has some very, very important work to do. And what I think coming out of those problems, what it needs to do is to look at what I call in shorthand anthropocentric traditions. How conceptualising anthropocentrism is now a crucial site of contestation. If in our concern for the natural world or other species besides the human, we take the centering of the human or its conceptual raising to preeminence as a philosophical problem worthy of explication, then eco-criticism has a task of seeking the mechanisms of that elevation in literature. I think that task worthwhile and has positive directions alongside critical work. For example, I think it is beginning to happen, but I see in part what I'm trying to do here is trying to push this a little bit further. One eco-critic argues that literature can be a form of redress, a countervailing gesture that can expose the ways in which the natural world evades and exceeds the power of human constructions. The claim is that literature bears within it some of the failures and anxieties of anthropocentric metaphysics, of what Agamben calls the anthropological machine, expelling the inhuman and finding images of the human in the non-human, patrolling boundaries in order to attempt a purification. Literature produces figures and scenes which both capture these efforts but show their inevitable failures. Literature then has the potential to be read as ostensibly charting the machine's progress or symptomatically revealing the natural world's withdrawal or final unavailability to representation. In this sense, the best writing on nature fails. and precisely reveals that failure to grasp animal, plant or earth, the non-human other that's, which stands before us, and we then apprehend that which we can call, following Adorno, the scar tissue in the anthropological vision, the abrasion of the human grasp or attempt at comprehending nature itself. Of course, if this echoes a defeatist attitude, denying we can understand a nature that withdraws sublimely from human understanding, then we might be tempted to posit a pure non-anthropocentrism, a biocentric or non-humanist, non-humanist, a-human, anti-humanist, etc., form of thought. But a moment's reflection tells us that this is impossible as a strict, that is, completely distinct alternative that would in some way annul the particular history of anthropocentrism. Thinkers as divergent as Mary Midgley and Jacques Derrida, who really don't like each other, agreed that a thoroughgoing non-anthropocentrism must imply successfully adequate conceptual demarcation of the properly human, a project which denies the given conditions for human thought. Both Midgley and Derrida, in fact, strangely enough, agree on that point. The border or boundary of the human and what we might grant as proper to it cannot function to decide and exclude utterly the non-human. But as Agamben and others like Derrida, Foucault and Adorno demonstrate, the history of modernity's success has been written in part with a language that has returned over again to attempt this discursive policing. I think here that what can be added here, the influence of advancing ecology as an explanation of living beings can add to this challenge of critically undermining anthropocentric and critically understanding anthropocentric traditions. Important tenets of ecology have a deep ontological character. All living and non-living things are integral parts of the biospherical web. The essence or identity of any living thing is the expression of connections and context. All life forms, including Homo sapiens, result from the same processes. Human social life is viewed as necessarily obeying these limitations, which condition everything we do, including the systems of knowledge and meaning production. So I think there's increasing acceptance of ecology of that sort of position, a deeper ontology as an explanatory paradigm, helps offer a way to reread the Robinson Crusoe philosopheme eco-critically and produce a type of critical counter-model of the everyman liberal subject that I suggested needs to be transformed in terms of moral agency. So I now turn to go back to Robinson Crusoe in the light of that. So I'll start, in fact, with Kafka wrote a one-sentence parable on Robinson Crusoe that brought out sharply a vital quality of the story, and I'll read the one sentence. It's longish, but from Franz Kafka, Parables and Paradoxes. Had Robinson Crusoe never left the highest, or more correctly, the most visible point of the island, from desire for comfort or timidity or fear or ignorance or longing, he would soon have perished. But since, without paying any attention to passing ships and their feeble telescopes, he started to explore the whole island and take pleasure in it, he managed to keep himself alive and finally was found, after all, by a chain of causality that was, of course, logically inevitable. This is less opaque than many of Kafka's short fragments. The parable projects a clear logical structure. If A, then C, but since B, then D. One decision leads one way, an alternate decision leads another. If Robinson had stayed atop the island, focused on being seen and rescued, then death would have followed. But since he left there and explored the island, then survival and eventual rescue became possible. More precisely, Kafka foregrounds the decision to overcome inner weakness, forego the obvious choice oriented towards hope, in favour of a choice of real immediacy, present life in one's surrounds. The outcast survives in spite of hope, not because of it. Kafka identified with this situation, and in one letter, likened his own writing back to home as Robinson Crusoe's flag hoisted at the highest point of the island, since he felt his home had long since floated away into eternity. And therefore his writing would not be received, or rather will not produce any more the anticipated reply, the call for oneself from the other, or the rescue that one hopes the other will deliver. Turning away from fixated hope, the highest but illusory point, or the castle in the air for Kafka, Robinson Crusoe will gradually fabricate his own life, which will become real rescue, or the reinsertion into the world of others again by a path taken through oneself. Kafka's self-identified Robinson art is particular but echoes many others, which seize on the modern archetype of the outsider or loner, the outcast or shipwrecked individual, the isolated subject, real or self-described. The situation of individual decision, which all subjects experience, is exemplified. We all stand before alternate life possibilities, which must be weighed and evaluated. However, we consider the pull of desire against conscious decision, at the very least the question of normativity for the ego reopens itself ad infinitum. If one sort of side of normativity must be compulsion, law, and the relation with others to which one is bound, by the same token, the valuing of any decision is at least in part experience without another. The normativity thus implied is alloyed with singular experience. Responsibility to one's decisions must to some extent be experienced as mine alone. To turn away from one's desire for the other to rescue one, as Kafka reads Robinson Crusoe is doing, in order to be self-made, is a particular dramatised version of self-imposed obligation to choose a shaping force on the self rather than defer to immediate desire. Christine Korsgaard, in the context of reflecting on normativity, calls such obligation the imposition of value on reluctant, recalcitrant, resistant matter, that is, the body or person. It is the compulsive power of form, and goes on to describe how Christianity utilised this for centuries in its own version of moral doctrine. Fallen humanity in the providential order ought to scrutinise desire, ought to repent, ought in that sense to reshape itself and seek salvation. Robinson Crusoe was, of course, a character cast into this situation. The starkness of his singular decisions and judgments are framed within a narrative of redemption, which begins from his headstrong refusal to follow his father's advice, that which he calls on his first ship, a breach of my duty to God and my father. The next 28 years of his life can be understood as his gradual atonement for a rebellion against not only the patriarch, but also figuratively against the God of Adam, who supplied a house only to have his son disrespect the provision. Pride cometh before the fall, and Crusoe's fall is, of course, initiated in the storm and shipwreck. As Hans Blumenberg argues in a great book, Shipwreck with Spectator, the shipwreck is one of the most potent of metaphors or paradigms standing for the risks of the journey of life. Leaving terra firma, literally or metaphorically, is an essential but necessary project in life, leaving home, setting out. Venturing one's person and possessions, the best efforts can also always be wrecked by the storms of the world. The ocean is part of human unnature. We cannot live there, and we cross it or reduce it to passage in order to make gain in our human endeavours. The unknown awaits. The world may deliver storms and wreck our endeavours as part of the providential scheme, which we cannot know. Pirates, criminals and rogues sail on the lawless seas, aiming to ruin the ships of individuals and the ships of state afloat on their voyages. Defoe's many writings on pirates and journeys to colonies, including those in Robinson Crusoe, reveal this as a constant preoccupation. The threat of unsteady conditions in life, or the unsteadiness of political life. Crusoe had chosen his venture, left home, and is beset by storms. To survive a shipwreck could count then as a miracle. Out of disaster, someone is plucked by the hand of God to continue their mortal life. And for Defoe, as a dissenting Presbyterian, the supernatural forces of the divine would indeed intercede in the world regularly. Crusoe is the only human survivor from his ship, the last. By the same token, washed up naked on an unknown shore, Crusoe begins again, a new or first man. Crusoe is either a last man, a first man, or both at the same time, as a representative of every man that Coleridge and Wordsworth already recognised reading Defoe in the early 19th century. Alone in solitude on the island, Crusoe is thrown back on himself, on his resources. Much of the narrative here is recapitulated in the many different edited versions. Robinson, the able individual, salvages what is useful from the wreck and reconstructs a life, reiterating as Watt and many other critics concur, is a self-made image of the man who answers his own authority, makes the world his world. He now has to form himself by the power of compulsion, as Korsgaard says. The text provides great empirical details of the things he collects, those he makes, and the natural items he finds on the island useful to his life. He counts and tabulates, plans and organises. As Virginia Woolf commented, Crusoe is forever counting his barrels and making sensible provisions for his water supply, nor do we ever find him tripping even in the matter of detail. Crusoe is a collector, an observer of things. The isolated human relates first of all to things in the world in order to create a place, in order to be more than just a lost thing himself. He must begin to fabricate a world. In the 18th century, things are counted and accounted for in new detail. Types are required as things are counted more and more. Difference is tied to number, which is tied to proportionality and relations with others into the future. Even if Robinson is alone, his accounting is future and proportion oriented. What will be the proper distribution of things into the future? And I believe that's why Derrida turns to Heidegger, the philosopher of Geworfenheit, thrownness, and the distinctions of the stone, the animal, and the human, in the section of Seminar 2 of The Beast and the Sovereign, with a discussion of Volton, the force or power to govern and arrange. I mean, it's a strange twinning that those of you read that text, Heidegger and Robinson Crusoe, but it's about the kind of gathering of things. Crusoe domesticates plants and animals. He explores and experiments with whatever is available. In obvious fashion, the good colonialist who will tame the wilderness and make it useful. But the domestication of plants and animals by Crusoe also forms an elaborate work alongside the domestication of his erring self. The alternation of narrative between his exploration and agricultural work with periods of intense self-scrutiny form two sides of the one process. He must make the island into an orderly territory, you might say re-territorialise it, in order to de-territorialise and then re-territorialise himself, we might say, following Deleuze. He begins a journal and writes both of events, but also his bodily and mental conditions. As some have noted, the writing of his time in the island is also a writing of himself, an account, a weighing up, an assessment of his life narrative, in order, as a Puritan, to assess the path of providence in his life. In bringing a certain order of human law to the island, Crusoe sets in play the project of determining the principles or laws of his life. Crusoe, the isolate on the island, is cut off from the mainland and from other humans. The laws of community are absent. The word isolate and island have the same Latin root, insulatus. Crusoe is an island. I think we can say that the island, which he calls his island of despair after his state of mind, and Crusoe are at one level of this imaginary world coextensive. And in thinking through this, I thought that as an opposed figure, and I need to set this up a little bit better, the very well-known meditation of John Donne, the works of whom Defoe would have certainly known as he trained to be a pastor as a young man, which exemplifies in the providential language of the generation before Defoe the supposed unity and inclusion of God's order from which Crusoe is excluded. A biography of Defoe states that his sermons of the 1680s were said to be very much like John Donne. Famous meditation 17 of Devotions Upon the Emergent Occasions, of course, no man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if a promontory were, as well as if a manor of thy friends or of thy own were. Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind, and therefore never seem to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. Crusoe's mortality haunts him in his solitude. Before he repents, he is visited by a terrible figure in a dream who says he is to die, but he awakes and he gets on with his mundane life. And it's the gradual accumulation then of actions and arrangement of the island that leads him out of that solitude towards others again. He will arrange and order the things, the living things, and eventually, of course, other humans in a formal parallel to his re-established self. As some commentators have argued, Crusoe, in order to make a world that can then stand as such for himself, he must become of this world and saturate himself in it, which of course across time he does, covered in goatskin, living in the earth, shaping pots and carving furniture. He both domesticates and creates his world, but this work of welding also recreates himself. Animals become his companions and conversationalists. the plants are tamed and eventually thrive under his hand. He becomes close to all these living things across generations. They become the living ground, which he has in part gathered, yet also surely gathers him. In some visual representations of Robinson Crusoe, they head for this sort of group thing very, very quickly. He appears as the head of a family of sorts, Friday at his side, animals grouped around like relatives, crops planted in the background, a range of wooden furniture and crafted pots collected. Great scenes. And, of course, then you've got the Swiss Family Robinson and all these other Robinsonites, etc. Now, of course, look, Crusoe does hunt and kill birds and animals and asserts the colonial right to take and utilise things, but he also husbands the flock of goats and keeps a parrot, dogs and cats. Certainly alone in nature, in his own terms, he is almost improperly human, filled with fear, particularly after the cannibals are discovered. But this condition is narrated as much as a result of his lone state of mind, unable to assess his real condition. I interpret this as one version of an ensemble of life that humans always, and now, and this is philosophically, this is what I think is important, humans have always lived with many other species and the inanimate very closely, in many different types of relations. Of course, everything from war, hunting, planting, harvesting, etc., to close domestic harmony. But it is not possible for human life to proceed on its own without other species of many kinds. Human life is therefore also other than itself in its very possibility. Life is relations of different forms in order for any singular form to exist. Human experience has always been influenced by such relations, but it's represented these in particular narrow ways, ensemble of life, but not in the terms of a full ecological understanding, but as a form of culturally imagined ensembles. Philosophically, the conditions necessary to human existence have been under-acknowledged in favour of these mythologies of anthropocentric predominance. In literature and popular discourse, we commonly tell stories of the natural world which reduce its complications to fragments of instinct or drive. So while our conception thinking of ensembles provides certain schema, corporeal experience of other creatures and things organised in cultural patterns must be part of the space of arrangement. This is another part of the text which I need to develop a bit. And I'd use, the ordering of domestication, I'd use Bourdieu here on habitus, where behaviour and comportment are carried in the body in the spaces made available by such ordering. Crusoe carries his civilised habitus onto the island but gradually transforms it amongst the ensemble of creatures and things gathered. Also, if we reflect on the use of the term agency, we understand its doubled and opposed meaning. To be an agent implies both autonomy and capacity for decision, yet to be an agent for another implies service to another's decision. Crusoe is an agent in both senses, a celebrated individual agent of action, yet also the agency through which an ensemble of life forms come to thrive. And certainly the early 18th century position on providence understood that some of the human condition was properly a passivity, awaiting a prompting towards action that would come from without. As Scott Gordon describes in his study of English literature, a loss of agency could be understood as the antidote to despair, which we, of course, regard these days as a very strange idea. A loss of agency could be understood as an antidote to despair. In the early 18th century, either spirit or nature would empower one through God's prompting. You were meant to wait to feel it. So, double sense of agency. On the basis of the island made Crusoe, or the Crusoe made island, the footprint of the other arrives, the mark finally of the beginning of human society again, even if Crusoe has to wait some time. The theory experiences again the Hobbesian uncertainty of what the demand of the other might be, will be eventually borne out as he discovers the cannibals. Crusoe thus enters a new phase of adjustment and domestication, where he must deal with the human threat. Cannibals signify a horror because they suggest not just a death and mutilation of the body, but also degeneration to a state of violence and violation of a particular kind. To kill and eat the other signifies the absence of any and all communication respect. Animals will avoid murdering and eating their own kind through ritual displays of submission. Cannibalism transcends all possibilities of such displacement. The other is neglected utterly as amenable for respect or mercy. The other is reduced to meat for eating. As such, the cannibal is completely disrespectful of the human and either nihilates or ignores its proper status. Crusoe's given up on waiting for the other's call. The appearance of cannibals signifies a violent inversion. He must defend the island from the incursion of those who refuse the call of the other. The inhuman carnivore threatens the prospect of human society returning to Crusoe's world and presents a radical anthropological other. Crusoe, in saving the man who will become his servant, Friday, kills two cannibals as an act of mercy and respect for the other potential victim. In recreating the social bond of obligation through this act, Crusoe re-establishes a human order with him at the head and doubles his human society. In fact, Friday will become a type of double, learning much from the man who is himself good at learning. In one of the very last episodes of the story, and I think this strange episode after Crusoe is rescued is for me, in fact, the last proper episode. Having escaped the island and travelling overland through the Pyrenees back to England, bears and wolves attack Crusoe and Friday. In one passage, Friday, for the traveller's entertainment, baits a bear to follow him up a tree, where he entices it into thinning branches in order for it to fall in a game of slapstick bravado. Friday is thus the willing colonised subject in a pointless but obviously highly symbolic game of animal baiting. The good servant who, despite his learning and accumulated civilised manners, still accepts his fragile place, choosing to risk his life for the sake of a laugh from his master. It recalls what Homi Bhabha calls the logic of the mimic man, the colonial subject who has become almost the same as the coloniser, but not quite, and can almost reverse the objectifying gaze back onto the coloniser, but not quite. We can read in this section how the threat of wilderness and animals unavailable for domestication are scripted to shore up the colonial hierarchy, in this case through a presentation of the willing Friday, literally dancing with a bear in a tree no less. Crusoe can be entertained by the mastery of creatures at the edges of civilised Europe, where the Pyrenees, of course, are traditionally a very dangerous forested area. Later, wolves are outrun in the narrative, and the travellers finally re-enter civilization, wealth and relations intact, the protagonist finally achieving his venture after almost three decades abroad. So, on this reading, Robinson Crusoe participates in a promontory literary version of the free liberal individual and placed for a significant part of the narrative in an ensemble of life. The protagonist, cast away from the others, must weigh and decide in solitude, the primitive model supposedly of a modern individual facing life in a social order that promotes anonymity and rational egoism. In a sense, Robinson Crusoe is one of the best texts for inciting the question of what would I do? The reader thrown back immediately into questions of self-reliance. I tried to argue that framing the emergence of that literary response are questions of how the properly human patrols its borders and attempts to contain representation, while inevitably the non-human, in fact, necessary relations with the non-human world appear around those borders, are subtending what we imagine to be secured for our self-understanding. The relevance and value of pursuing how literature and modernity has posited such narratives can, of course, be tied to the principles of eco-criticism, which attempt, in its better forms, to scrutinise literature's part in establishing such traditions of anthropocentric arrogance, but questioning such traditions. Critical reading, how deeply that has been established in our contemporary self-descriptions, connect with the problem of moral agency from environmentalism. How and for what reasons will billions of subjects positioned as free consumers in markets that draw down on the world resources and ecological domains decide to alter their values? What sort of alternate cultural politics or changes in what we regard as some of our hard-won modern liberties and rights will be politically possible when our entrenched attitudes to the natural world accorded as the mere ground to human potential and not, as it increasingly appears, a series of limits and crises on the near horizon. So I think, just as a last comment, what I tried to do here is just look at the core idea of the isolated modern liberal subject and how changing oneself, because the compulsion of form, as Korsgaard calls it, is a kind of central question. And I think aesthetic discourses such as literature kind of show us in this kind of symbolic form what the way in which that question overlaps with a political and scientific is a kind of aesthetics of the subject through obligation, I think. And ultimately, I kind of agree, I think, with Korsgaard's position that it's a public obligation that needs to be created for subjects to kind of tie those domains together.